Canada would receive a fleet of nuclear-powered submarines. These would be built at Adelaide in South Australia with the help of the UK and the US. Australia confirmed that it would also be acquiring Tomahawk cruise missiles and joint air-to-surface standoff missiles from the US. In exchange, the United States will expand its already giant military footprint in Australia. The United States and Australia already have very close ties, being two of the Five Eyes members, along with the UK, Canada, and New Zealand. The US already has several military bases and around 2,500 Marines on permanent rotation in Australia. In addition to its own bases, the Asia Pacific Journal writes that, quote, "The US military has access to all major Australian Defence Forces training areas, Northern Australian Royal Air Force airfields, port facilities in Darwin and Fremantle." With AUKUS, those numbers would increase, as would the types of ordnances, as Peter Dutton, the Australian Defence Minister, confirmed. During a press conference, he went on to say that Australia and the United States will be significantly enhancing our force posture cooperation, increasing interoperability and deepening alliance activities in the Indo-Pacific. This will include greater air cooperation through rotational deployments of all types of US military aircraft to Australia. Now, while this agreement has been marketed as a defense pact, there are many who feel that Australia is giving much more than it's receiving, conceding much of its territorial, political, and military sovereignty to the United States. And nothing could be more emblematic of Australia's subservience to the United States than Joe Biden forgetting the Australian Prime Minister's name, Scott Morrison, during the unveiling of AUKUS.
Thank you, Boris, and I want to thank that fellow down under. Thank you very much, pal.
Besides not being able to say the name of the Australian Prime Minister, neither Biden nor Johnson and Morrison actually mentioned China by name. If you go and watch their full speeches, you'll only hear them say the Indo-Pacific.
The Indo-Pacific.
The Indo-Pacific.
We all recognize the imperative of ensuring peace and stability in the Indo-Pacific over the long term.
It's no secret that this entire thing is aimed at China. This is China's region, after all, and the West has been fear-mongering about them for years. Reacting to AUKUS, the spokesperson for the Chinese Foreign Ministry, Li Jianzhao, said that, quote, "This severely undermines regional peace stability, intensifies arms race, and undercuts international non-proliferation efforts. It's highly irresponsible and shows double standards on using nuclear export for geopolitical games." So why China? What has China done that is so bad that these three countries are trying to gang up against it? Well, I think this clip from CNN might have some of the answers.
The trade routes that we use on the open seas need to be protected in the US, Australian, and UK view. They need to be protected by our collective forces in order to make sure that no other navy can interfere with the trade routes as they exist right now. So that means any oil, for example, that comes from the Middle East, any raw materials that come from Africa, things that China depends on a great deal.
But have they been doing that? Have the Chinese been stopping those trade routes?
Not yet, but the fear is that they could.
Well, there you go. You heard it straight from the horse's mouth. The colonel here is plainly saying China hasn't done anything. And more importantly, he's telling you the real reason behind all this. It's all about economic interests. It's about controlling shipping lanes, trade routes, oil and other natural resources near China. Which again, remember, China is the world's largest manufacturing country. And when they talk about countering China, this phrase, they use it all the time, but what does it mean? Why does China need to be countered? America has tons of military bases already surrounding China, not the other way around. And what is the United Kingdom doing on the other side of the planet? Do you know that China is Australia's largest trading partner? Why should Australia sour relations with them at the behest of the US? What, to satisfy America's foreign policy goals? Perhaps this is more to do with the West feeling nervous that China has a stronger, faster-growing economic model. China is on track to overtake the US and become the world's largest economy. China has the Belt and Road Initiative, a modern revival of Silk Road trade route. It just recently integrated Iran into it, among many other countries. China doesn't go around bombing other places to steal their resources. China has lifted millions of its own citizens out of poverty. It has a different mindset, a different social and economic system from the US. And Australia seems to be losing its sovereignty and essentially becoming a giant airbase for the Americans. Australia says it's non-nuclear, but will the United States respect that? Who's to say they won't keep nuclear missiles on Australian soil in secret? Does the US view Australia as expendable, perhaps just as a vassal state that it can exploit for its imperialist ambitions in a potential confrontation with China? To find out more, I thought I'd ask Dr. Alan Patience. He's an honorary principal fellow in the School of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Melbourne. He's taught political and Asian studies at universities in Australia and Japan, and has occupied visiting professorships in China, Taiwan, Burma, and Papua New Guinea. His work focuses on Australian foreign policy. Dr. Alan Patience, thanks so much for joining me today. It's great to have you on.
My pleasure.
Professor, you recently wrote that Australia is repeating certain foreign policy and defense mistakes from the last century. I was hoping if you can maybe elaborate on those mistakes for us.
Okay. Well, I was referring in that case to the 1919 peace conference in Paris after World War I. The Australian representative was our Prime Minister at the time, Mr. Billy Hughes, who was one of the leading architects of what was called the White Australia policy. He was an out-and-out racist and particularly disliked Asian people. The Japanese, of course, were represented at the peace conference in a quite significant delegation. They made some proposals that upset the Australian Prime Minister. The first proposal was that all German territories in the Pacific should be encouraged and helped by Australia and Japan together towards independence, to end colonialism, German colonialism. And the second proposal the Japanese made was that the new charter for the League of Nations that was being formed at much the same time should have an anti-racist clause in its charter. Now, Billy Hughes was absolutely horrified at these two suggestions. He opposed them bitterly. He was extremely rude in the conference proceedings. He used to put his foot up on the table and shout and just gesticulate, particularly at the Japanese, telling them off. And as a result, the Japanese, first of all, were humiliated at that conference. Eventually, they withdrew from the League of Nations. And certainly, that was a contribution to the enmity that was created between Japan and Australia in World War II in the Pacific theater. And what I was trying to suggest is that Scott Morrison, our present Prime Minister, is doing exactly the same thing. He's now being very rude about China in a number of international forums and provoking China's hostility. So I think history is repeating itself.
When it comes to Australia and what Australia has to gain from all this, these nuclear submarines, it's said they won't be arriving anytime soon. As a matter of fact, we've heard the year 2040 being floated around. So if Australia has to wait two decades for these submarines, what exactly are America and the UK gaining in the meantime from this partnership with Australia, especially in terms of being able to use Australian territory and soil?
First of all, I think it's important to note that there is no submarine at the moment. All there is a promise that nuclear power will be made available for whatever submarine is chosen in a time frame of the next 18 months. So it's still a fantasy. It's not a reality at all. But what will the Americans achieve? Well, for a long time now, Australia's military capacity, defence capacity, has been, and I've got to use an awful official word here, interoperable with the United States military. That is to say, we are really just a very small part of the US military and defense arrangements in the Asia-Pacific region. This now consolidates that relationship as far as the Americans are concerned. There's been some talk emerging in Australia, particularly during the time of Trump's presidency, that maybe we can't rely on America any longer. And that's a feeling that's been growing. And the Americans want to counter this. And they've come in now with this proposal. And at the same time, and by the way, the concerns about America's reliability, we've had one former prime minister, for example, saying that it's time to rip up the alliance with the United States. And that would mean, amongst other things, kicking Pine Gap, which is a huge American spy base in the middle of Australia that's been spying on China and other East and Southeast Asian countries. Getting rid of that, for example, and that would really remove a major part of the US's intelligence capacity, gathering capacity in this region. So America is in pushing us into this arrangement, if you like, is consolidating its grip on Australia's sovereignty very strongly. As far as the British are concerned, I think it's just empire nostalgia. They still think of Australia as a colony, and in many respects we still are a colonial mindset. For the British, they might get one of their submarines selected, but it's very unlikely. I'm sure it'll be an American submarine.
You mentioned Australian sovereignty. What does AUKUS entail exactly for Australia's sovereignty? How does it get out of this colonial mindset?
I think it's important to note that in international politics, international relations, Australia styles itself as a middle power, a so-called middle power. I've argued elsewhere that there are different kinds of middle powers, but the kind of middle power that Australia is as a dependent middle power. Its claims to have a kind of middle power status are entirely reliant on its alliances with big powers, and in this case, the United States. So already, as a dependent middle power, Australia's sovereignty has been severely constrained. As the former Prime Minister that I was referring to earlier, Malcolm Fraser, he was a Conservative Prime Minister, by the way, who's saying, let's get rid of the American alliance. And he was saying, look, Australia has very little sovereignty. And AUKUS, as they call this new strange arrangement, is yet further evidence that we are very lacking in sovereignty, that we will do, we will always do as we're told. And that's evident, for example, in that Australia has been into every single war that the United States has had since the end of World War II, during World War II as well. We've been into every single war, the Korea Peninsula War, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, and so on. It's quite extraordinary. In many respects, we're a very warmongering country, but very keen to be with America in its wars.
Dr. Alan Patience, thank you so much for your time, Professor. Really a pleasure speaking with you and having you on.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
AUKUS has caused a real diplomatic row with the French. France is actually very upset with all this, not because Western imperialists are antagonizing China, but because they didn't get the contracts and the money to help do it. France had a deal worth 90 billion Australian dollars to build diesel power submarines for Australia. Without informing the French, Scott Morrison just went and ripped up the contract and entered Australia into this new alliance instead with the US and the UK. I guess he figured that American nuclear-powered submarines would be much better. And France, of course, considers this to be a real stab in the back and is so angry it pulled out of a planned ceremony with the U.S. commemorating the 240th anniversary of the Battle of Cape. French President Emmanuel Macron said that it's important for Europe to stop being naive and assert its independence from the United States. The French are so outraged that the defense minister pulled out of talks with the U.K., and in an unprecedented move, France even recalled its ambassadors to Australia and the U.S. To gain further insight into this diplomatic row, joining me is Bruce Haig, an Australian political commentator, author, and former diplomat. He served in several countries, first in South Africa, where he made friends with anti-apartheid activists and even helped some of them escape the country. He also served in Afghanistan, Iran, Indonesia, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Sri Lanka. Bruce, it's great to have you on. Welcome to the communique.
Thank you. Pleasure.
So, Bruce, when we speak about the relationship that Australia has with France, how does AUKUS and the diplomatic fallout that's resulted from it impact the relationship?
Richard, that's a good question because the French are quite influential, as you know, in Europe. Britain's out of it, much to everybody's delight, I would hope, and think. But in its present form. I mean, Britain is still hasn't had the social revolution that it needs. It's still a hugely unequal society and racist to boot. But so France has got a considerable influence in Europe, and it will bring that influence to bear. Merkel's about to go. We don't know who will replace her, but whoever replaces her will not have the experience that Merkel had. So Macron is now a senior statesperson in Europe, and he's really angry. So I can't imagine that the trade deal that was in being drawn up will happen. It'll be pushed to one side, and it won't be revised, I don't think, until Morrison's government has been voted out of office in Australia.
So we know that they didn't tell the French about their plans to rip up this deal. Could you maybe tell us about who else was left in the dark in terms of the Australian government, the Australian Defence Forces? Because there were also other people in Australia who didn't know about this. Is that correct?
Yes, that's certainly it seems that way. It would seem that this is a deal that's been done between people in the United States or people around Biden and Morrison and some of his staff members. But it seems, and maybe it includes Dutton, who's the Minister for Defence, but it seems it didn't include the Department of Defence, because they wrote a letter to the French, which the French received on the same day that the Australians broke the contract. So, to me, officials within our Department of Defence were not in the loop. They don't know the cost. I mean, when you're spending 85 to 100 billion of taxpayers' money on an item like as large as this, you would normally go out to contract and say, look, and you'd, the lead-in time with the French would be over a period of 6 months or a year of saying, look, we're going to have to break this contract and discuss the terms of breaking the contract and all those sorts of things so that you didn't upset the French. So the submarine deal, they're saying we wouldn't get the submarines until 2040 at the earliest and maybe 2050, which to me means that the submarine deal isn't a real deal at all. It's a smokescreen in order to get the United States into Australia and get their nuclear submarines based in Fremantle, at the Garden Island and in the Northern Territory, perhaps build another port, get their stealth bombers and B-52s permanently based in Tyndall Air Force Base in the north, and maybe build some other bases in Northern Australia.
So what are the motivations behind AUKUS? Why this pact at this point in time with these three countries?
The Americans are getting increasingly worried about, they've got themselves into a mindset, they're paranoid, they're feeding off their own hysteria about China. So they've got themselves into a mindset that they need to act very, very quickly. And so they came up with this idea of gazumping the French and their submarine deal, pushing the French out of, or marginalising the French in the Pacific, giving the primary role to the US. Johnson's just a hanger-on in all of this. He's trying to get some British glory day back after the mess up of Brexit, and it's a complete mess. So Johnson's a hanger-on, and America is now happy enough to have Johnson hanging on, but wants Australia as a base for its naval assets and for army. I don't know what they're going to use the army for, to occupy the islands in the South China Sea. But, I mean, they just want a presence in Australia, an increased military presence. And that increased military presence will give them control over the Australian, a greater control over the Australian political process. So AUKUS is really about the Americans wanting to use Australia, as they did in the Second World War, as a kind of a large aircraft carrier, and give some legitimacy to what they're on about, which is confronting China because of their fear of China's rivalry.
So when we talk about trade, Australia's largest trading partner is China. How does this whole situation affect the relationship with the Chinese? This has always seemed odd to me. You know, Australia needs China, and yet we have this behavior from the United States pushing Australia into confrontation. So how does this affect the relationship with China? What's the Chinese response been? And what's the response been from the other countries and territories in the Indo-Pacific to this pact?
Well, in Southeast Asia, other countries are not at all happy. They haven't expressed themselves forcefully in public, but behind the scenes, they're very angry and concerned. China, of course, is they won't deal with Morrison, and they won't deal with his government. Morrison doesn't have any life experience. He is unable to process these sorts of relationships. He hasn't got a clue. China is now being referred to within circles in Australia, certainly by the Americans, but we've picked up. They're the enemy. So, you know, we're referring to our major trading partner as the enemy. I don't even begin to understand the logic of that. From Australia's point of view, China's not going anywhere and neither are we. As much as we'd like to sit offshore from America, it's not going to happen. We're firmly grounded here at the bottom of Asia, and that's our future and that's our destiny. And China is China, and it's going to be there, and it's going to continue to influence the states around it in the Pacific and in the region. Countries are going to pick up with Belt and Road, and they're going to want the infrastructure that China's providing and promising.
Bruce Haig, thank you so much for your time. Such a pleasure speaking with you. Despite the claim that AUKUS will boost peace and stability in the region, it already seems to be achieving the opposite. China will perceive a heightened presence of a foreign military as a threat, just like any country would, and naturally want to defend itself. Having more British, American, and Australian forces trying to provoke China is only going to escalate things and maybe lead to an arms race or, worse, a military confrontation. The Americans said they would bring peace and stability to the Middle East. Look how that turned out. You know, America and Britain, they just go park fleets of warships, they fly nuclear bombers on Iran's doorstep, or in this case, China's doorstep, and then talk about countering China as if China is the one camped out in the Florida Keys. This is absurd. Just imagine the reaction if China put its warships in the English Channel or off the coast of California. They would lose it. Just look at the response when the Soviet Union put missiles in Cuba in 1962. They're still talking about it to this day. You know, last time I checked, China isn't the one who just pulled out of Afghanistan after occupying it for 20 years. China didn't commit war crimes in Iraq and Libya. China doesn't have 800 military bases around the world. China offers a different economic model, an alternative way of doing things that doesn't involve aggression and imperialism. China's way of doing things is based on agreement and cooperation, and is soon to become the world's largest economic power. Australia has always clung to Uncle Sam's coattails and needs the United States to feel that it can project a certain degree of power. Now, the United Kingdom longs for the old days of its empire. It just wants to appear relevant after Brexit. That's why they formed AUKUS. As for America, after Afghanistan, America needs a new enemy to justify its $740 billion military budget and to keep expanding its empire and ensure corporate profits. This is the crux of the issue. Capitalists, imperialists, they hate competition. They want to monopolize. They want to assert dominance and control over every market, every situation. And in the great power struggle between the West and China, the West is scared. Not because China actually poses a threat, but because China proposes an alternate way of doing things and is able to rival them through a different model, making theirs look outdated, weak, and obsolete. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The limelight. Millions of Americans around the country face the prospect of losing their homes after the Supreme Court on Thursday, 26th of August, rejected the Biden administration's latest federal moratorium on evictions, a decision that poses a new and unwelcome problem for a White House already grappling with domestic and international challenges. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Alan Rappaport, Sophie Kasikov, and Connor Doherty. The piece is titled, Supreme Court's Decision Opens Doors to Millions of Evictions. Stay with us for more. Millions of Americans around the country face the prospect of losing their homes after the Supreme Court on Thursday, 26th of August, rejected the Biden administration's latest federal moratorium on evictions, a decision that poses a new and unwelcome problem for a White House already grappling with domestic and international challenges. The court's ruling has once again thrust President Joe Biden into the middle of a fight to help prevent people from being evicted as the Delta variant of the coronavirus surges, and as Democrats remain unable to muster enough votes to pass a new ban on evictions. Absent legislation, there are few easy fixes. The administration is struggling to speed the flow of billions of dollars in federal funding to people who are behind in rent because of economic hardship associated with the coronavirus pandemic. The scramble to find a solution follows the 8-page majority opinion the Supreme Court issued on Thursday evening, 26th of August, that said the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, had exceeded its authority in acting to prevent landlords from evicting tenants during a public health crisis. No one knows exactly how many tenants are in jeopardy, but the Census Bureau reported this week that more than 1 million people were very likely to face eviction for non-payment of rent over the next 2 months, with millions more behind on rent payments and in arrears. With no legal avenues remaining to take action on its own, the Biden administration issued a plea to state and local officials on Friday, 27th of August, to do more to help. In a letter, top cabinet members urged governors, mayors, county executives and judges and administrators to extend local eviction moratoriums. The letter from Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, Marcia L. Fudge, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and Attorney General Merrick Garland also asked them to enact policies that would require landlords to apply for federal aid before enforcing evictions, and recommended that evictions be delayed whilst rental aid applications were pending. Troubles facing the Biden administration's $46.5 billion emergency rental assistance program were clear this week when Treasury Department figures showed that 89% of the money had yet to be distributed by state and local governments. Just $1.7 billion made it to tenants or landlords in July, as states and cities continue to grapple with how to streamline the application processes. With a court decision looming, the Treasury Department rolled out changes to the program on Wednesday, including additional attempts to absolve local governments of federal punishment if they provided money to those who do not actually need help. The agency issued a directive to local officials that they allow tenants to use self-reported financial information on aid applications as a first rather than a last resort, while giving states permission to send bulk payments to landlords and utility companies in anticipation of federal payouts to tenants. The Supreme Court's ruling divided lawmakers along party lines on Friday, 27th of August, with Republicans applauding the decision and Democrats demanding legislative action to address a looming eviction crisis. A group of progressive House Democrats wrote a letter to Speaker Nancy Pelosi and to Senator Chuck Schumer, the majority leader in the Senate, calling on congressional leaders to include an extended moratorium that would last through the end of the pandemic in upcoming legislation. An effort by House Democrats to extend the eviction ban failed in July. Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, said on Friday, 27th of August, that President Biden would welcome congressional action. Barring that, she said the White House was focused on finding other ways to ease the burden on tenants by encouraging the delay of evictions and getting financial assistance out the door more quickly. A senior White House official said there were no long-shot measures that the administration was waiting to deploy. It will continue to see if agencies like HUD can do more to stall evictions, and it will accelerate efforts to get states to pump out relief money faster. The wave of evictions is coming at a fragile juncture for the economic recovery, and as the fiscal support that Congress approved during the initial stages of the pandemic is winding down. The effect on tenants will vary tremendously from state to state and from city to city, said Diane Yentl, the president of the National Low-Income Housing Coalition. In some states like California, New Jersey, and Virginia, tenants will temporarily be allowed to remain in their homes thanks to statewide protections. In a statement on Friday, Governor Kathy Hochul of New York derided the Supreme Court's decision as appalling and insensitive. The state is considering calling a special session of the state legislature to protect residents from eviction. But in other states, especially where evictions have already been progressing through the courts of law, people could lose their homes swiftly. The eviction process can take anywhere from a matter of days in some states to weeks or months in other states. But Ms. Yentl said She expected that many tenants would leave their homes before undergoing a formal eviction process in an effort to avoid landing an eviction on their record, which would make it harder to find housing in the future. Tenants in many states, it has been clear for months that they're on their own. Judges in Texas have been serving evictions since last March, when the state Supreme Court refused to extend an order that gave judges the authority to enforce the CDC moratorium, after a federal district court in Tennessee found that the moratorium was unlawful in July. Judges in parts of Tennessee and Ohio have allowed eviction proceedings to continue as normal. Elsewhere, landlords have been able to skirt the moratorium by citing reasons other than non-payment of rent as justification for eviction. The struggle to get assistance to tenants is in many ways just an illustration of a fact that has been true for several decades. The United States has never had or tried to build a national-level system to keep its citizens secure in their homes. Now it is trying to establish one on the fly during a pandemic, with predictable results. While rental aid is now flowing much faster, since June, California has more than quadrupled its pace of payments, many of the country's most vulnerable tenants live in informal housing arrangements like illegal garage conversions or packed apartments with one leaseholder, making it difficult for aid programs that often require lease agreements to reach. Across the country, the news of the moratorium ending filled struggling tenants with fear. Brian Fitzpatrick, a 59-year-old, fell behind on the monthly rent of $550 for his one-bedroom apartment in St. Louis, Missouri, after his unemployment benefit expired and he was unable to return to work after a fall left him with broken ribs. He applied for rental assistance but said he had yet to receive a response. You could be sitting here thinking everything is good, and then you got the sheriff at the door talking about, you've got to get out, he said.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. Before we follow Javad, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, to the desert regions in South Khorasan province, an area of vast desert, sand dunes, and aridness as far as the eye can see. But amid what looks like arid wasteland, at first are wonderful and amazing surprises, including canyons, freshwater springs, and traces of past civilizations. But perhaps what is even more amazing, the next part of the program, is that this dry, arid land yields the world's most coveted spice and Iran's prized red gold, saffron.
I leave behind the ruins of Dihuk and its beautiful architecture for my main destination, which is the terraced saffron farms of Esfandiar, a patchwork of little farms that demands the attention of any visitor. The name Esfandiar was derived from the word espand, or wild rue plants that grow in abundance in and around this village. In the spring season, these perennial plants make the mountains surrounding Esfandiar all the more beautiful. In my opinion, this village is a masterpiece, home to many and varied beauties in and around it. The people of Esfandiar are kind, faithful, and hardworking. Farming is the main occupation of the people living in this part of the country, and their main produce is Iran's famed red gold, that is, saffron. The fragrant, vivid crimson threads are known by almost everybody around the world, and has forever been the world's most expensive spice. In the words of researchers, the history of saffron goes back thousands of years. Iran was the first place where these beautiful flowers were planted. And after Iran's neighboring countries such as India, Syria, and Lebanon found out about it, it was also planted in Greece for the first time. The word zafaran is the Arabicized version of the word zarparan, meaning a flower with petals of gold. Saffron threads are plucked from the flower Saffron crocus and used mainly as a seasoning and coloring agent in food. Historically, saffron has been among the most expensive spices in the world. Harvesting saffron is so labor-intensive. Every 150,000 crocus flowers that weigh approximately 75 kilos yields a meager 1 kilo of this sought-after spice. The crocus bulb grows multiple flowers for several years, but after that, the number of its buds decreases by the year. Still, there have been instances where 30-year-old bulbs bloomed too. Around the world, saffron is used as food seasoning, medicine, dyeing agent, and fragrance. At the moment, Iran is the world's biggest producer of saffron, accounting for 90% of the world's production. Saffron has been used as a coloring agent for 50,000 years. Signs of that application have been discovered in drawings found in caves in Iraq and across the Achaemenid Persian Empire. Sumerians used it as medicine and for making certain potions. Iran's South Khorasan province is the main producer of saffron in the country. The reason I've chosen Esfandiar is the many other stunning sights to see apart from the beautiful saffron farms, the beautiful pomegranate, fig, and almond gardens, the lofty mountains behind the village reaching to the skies, the vast terraced saffron farms, and a very hospitable people who are a valuable asset for Iran. Add to that the beautiful ancient village of Esfandiar that has lain uninhabited for around 30 years for fear of earthquakes. All beauties have turned Esfandiar into a peerless little paradise in the heart of the desert. I'm overjoyed at the knowledge that the village has maintained its original shape, everything from the architecture to the farmlands. Thanks to my good friend Abbas Amiri, a village council member and a school teacher, and the other responsible inhabitants of the village, no one is allowed to make even the smallest changes to the architecture of the buildings in the village and of those nearby. I hope that the authorities of the Cultural Heritage Organization and the responsible villagers living here will join forces in preserving and renovating the unique architecture of the buildings in Esfandiar, give local and foreign tourists a chance to relish in such a beautiful bucolic environment, and leave a precious legacy for posterity. Additionally, a move like that will help the country's tourism industry to thrive and create jobs for the locals, provided that not a single modern structure is built in this area, and the landscape is clear of paved roads, power posts, and other eyesores. I spend the whole day walking around in the mountains surrounding Esfandiar and taking beautiful photos of the village from different angles. I'm supposed to accompany my good friend Amir, a village council member and high school teacher, and his kindly wife to a saffron farm. I want to see up close how they and other villagers pick the saffron threads. It's freezing. It's 6:30 in the morning, and most of the villagers have already sat down in a squatting position on their farms picking saffron-bearing flowers. I really didn't want to get out of my comfortable bed and come out here in this biting cold and dry weather. But the best time to pick those flowers and to see the farmers at work is the very early cold hours of morning. Apparently, it has to be cold, and it should still be dark when they start picking the flowers. I better get going. Very cold, very. It is mid-fall and the best time to harvest the saffron. The cold early morning fall weather in the desert is ice cold. Time is of the essence for these saffron farmers, so they have to make the best use of the time they have. From the day when the first saffron crocuses burst into flower, the farmers have around 15 days to pick all of them. Therefore, they cannot wake up anytime they want and go to work anytime they please. There is a certain time during all those 15 days at which the farmers can pick the flowers, and that is only the early morning hours. All the villagers, men and women, young and old, lend a helping hand on the farm during this period. It takes a certain degree of skill to pick the flowers, and the older folks of Esfandiar are master pickers, hands down. If you leave those flowers under the sun for too long after they have bloomed, your saffron is going to lose most of its original aroma and taste. It diminishes the quality of your saffron, as if the aroma of the saffron gets released into the air and disappears forever. That's what I'm told. You have to pick the buds with the longest stems, and you have to do it fast. There is no alternative to the human hand when it comes to picking these flowers. No machines, no automatons, no nothing. The men and women of the village spend hours squatting or doubling down while picking the flowers. The cold weather and the time crunch on the one hand, and the pressure on the farmers' knees and backs on the other, make the job ever more difficult. The tips of the fingers tingle from the bitter cold, and nagging pain starts to be felt in the knees and back. The work is agonizing and toilsome. Desert dwellers are tough human beings, and do not easily give up in the face of the difficulties presented to them by life. These people's entire being is made up of hope and love of life. They are eternally grateful to God, even when doing the most difficult of work. The young people, too, hum local songs as they work. After spending only a couple of hours with Amir and his family on their farm, I'm completely worn out. The pain in my back and knees is excruciating, but I feel great, because during those 3 hours, I got to see firsthand what these hardworking people go through. I can feel their pain, But there's something that upsets me and all of Iran's saffron farmers. Unfortunately, the farmers do the lion's share of the work in producing saffron. A case in point is the backbreaking harvesting process, but it's the middleman who stands to make most of the profit. That's an issue that calls for proper management and careful planning. The farmers need help to cash in on the result of their hard work, to make a profit that makes it all worth their while. Another big problem is a lack of proper, internationally interesting packaging industry in Iran for exporting saffron. A country like Spain is making the best of this opportunity. It buys Iran's high-quality saffron at a very low price, puts it in beautiful, modern packaging, and re-exports it to other countries in its own name and at a much higher price. The margin of profit is staggering, and that's what the farmers here have been complaining about. I am depressed after watching the farmers work so hard and hearing out their problems, but Amir has a present for me to cheer me up. To refresh themselves and shake off the cold after the working hours, the farmers get together somewhere next to their farms and brew themselves some fresh tea laced with fresh saffron in a pot on fire made from dry sticks. Locals here believe that saffron tea cheers you up. It makes you laugh. It helps freshen you up. But for someone like me, the question that comes to mind is, how can you not be happy when you hang around with such hardworking, kind, pure souls? How can you sit down with these folks, sip saffron tea with them, and not be filled with joy? The fact is that even without this tea, saffron tea I mean, you get filled with peace and happiness when you hang around with people who spend all day from morning till evening doing backbreaking work. Cheers. After imbibing that delicious saffron-flavored tea one sip at a time, I decide to sit down with one of the elders of Esfandiar, and that is none other than Mr. Danai. He tells me about the desert people's frugal existence, about their simple lifestyle, about the tough days of famine many years ago, and the perseverance and resilience of his fellow villagers in the face of the vicissitudes of life. The farmers don't have any time to waste. Therefore, after picking the flowers, they usually sit down together and start the next phase of saffron production, which is plucking the stigmas from the flowers. That's why I believe those who live in deserts or near them are very patient people. See for yourself. Take a look around. It took a lot of patience for them to turn this steep surface into a terraced farmland. Then, with a lot of hardship, they planted the saffron bulbs in it, spent months attending to them and waiting for them to yield. As far as I know, saffron crocuses bloom once a year. It takes a lot of elbow grease to cultivate them. They don't need much water, but still growing them is no walk in the park. Everything about saffron requires a lot of hard work and patience. That's why I've come to believe that desert dwellers are very stoic. Whatever they do calls for a lot of patience, and if they aren't patient, things won't happen. They won't prosper. The pain Mr. Amiri has in his knees and back is a pain that everybody here shares. All these people work really hard on these farms. And as I say, those living in desert climates are super patient human beings. Being in their company gives you the kind of peace that defies description. The last stage in the production of saffron involves spreading the stigmas on a proper surface and leaving them to dry. And that's a job that has to be done with a lot of care and skill. Otherwise, the quality of the end product will be impacted. In the end, the middlemen come to the villages, buy the dried saffron from the farmers, and sell it at staggering prices after proper packaging. I have high hopes for this beautiful village to be reconstructed and renovated. I hope that on my next trip to Esfandiar, I see many tourists here.
seriously, it's...
There aren't many places on Earth that share the same natural, architectural, agricultural, and anthropological variety as Esfandiar's. But, unfortunately, those beautiful houses you see behind me, although they used to be people's homes one day, now lay in ruins. No one is paying adequate attention to all the historical, cultural, and architectural beauties of our beloved country. I'm sure each one of those houses in this beautiful mountainous region, with all these vast terraced saffron farms and its beautiful gardens, not to mention its very hospitable residents, I'm sure if they are renovated, they can act as hotels in this region to accommodate tourists coming from other countries and, of course, local tourists traveling to this region. They can become beautiful hotels offering peaceful moments to those staying at them. My trip to South Khorasan has come to an end. I'm leaving with beautiful memories and valuable knowledge of this region of Iran. Before setting out for this part of the country from the capital city, I wouldn't even dream of such spectacular scenery and such kind human beings. I traveled to this area to see the saffron crocuses growing in the desert. I found the beauties of South Khorasan as a treasure trove, each of which is as beautiful as Iran's famed saffron. All this area needs to turn it into a major tourist attraction is proper attention and management on the part of government officials. And all that is possible if the traditional lifestyle of the folks living here does not undergo any radical changes, and provided the untouched scenery in these areas is not despoiled by modern residential and industrial structures. The beautiful face of deserts and the wilderness, the sand dunes and mountains, the animal and plant species living in deserts, an unpolluted blue sky, clean air, beautiful, vacant yet livable villages, the farms and gardens of the area, and on top of them all, the genuine and hospitable people with a rich culture. Each and every one of them is as precious as the saffron produced in the desert of South Khorasan. All I wish for is for all these assets to be preserved and protected for future generations.
Perhaps next time you enjoy another Persian dish with the exquisite scent of saffron, you will remember the terraced saffron farms of Esfandiar and the kind and hardworking farmers who plant the little purple flowers and harvest strands of red gold. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. Goodbye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Thank you.